Postscript Media, podcast for a changing planet.
Oh, I'm a dream customer.
Me too.
Because you never return.
I'm a dream customer. I will just keep it and suffer with it.
This is Hot Buttons, a show about the future of fashion and culture on a changing planet. I'm Christina Binkley. I'm a contributing writer at Vogue Business and The Wall Street Journal. This week, returns. The more we shop, the more we return. And the more we shop online, it gets even worse. Retailers have embraced easy, free returns as a way to grab market share, but it's coming at a cost to the companies and to the planet. We'll look at just how bad the data is, talk about what can be done to manage returns, and hopefully we're going to find some companies that are getting it right. This won't be the only time we talk about returns, but we're starting out today with a look at just how bad the problem has gotten. Then, in a sign of good news, it's getting harder for fashion brands to get away with greenwashing. Yay! Applause all around. In the UK, three brands have come under the gun by the nation's trade regulator for making green claims they can't back up. And here in the US, a class action lawsuit against H&M for their labeling practices has appeared in New York. We love accountability, and it's a good week to talk about how we're seeing more of it. Then we're going to finish with things big and little that are pressing our buttons. I'm joined by my regular co-hosts, Shilla Kim Parker and Rachel Kibbe. Hi, guys.
Hey, Christina.
Hi, Christina.
Shilla is the CEO and co-founder of Thrilling, a marketplace for vintage powered by mom-and-pop shops. And Rachel is the founder of Circular Services Group, an advisory firm focused on circularity in fashion. So we had a couple of days ago really interesting, was that an email exchange or Slack? I can't
email.
Remember, but... Was it email?
Yeah, we went long.
long form. We might as well write each other letters.
Right. I sent you a handwritten note about it, actually.
We had been looking at the latest Vogue cover with Olena Zelenska, and we had really different takes. I have to say, I was like, yeah, this is meaty. This is not just a fashion editorial. We're like seeing portraits, what's their life like in there? There's like sandbags in the presidential, whatever that was, compound. You guys had a different take, I think, than I did, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm in between probably your reaction and Rachel's reaction. But first, you know, so Olga Zelenska, the wife of Ukrainian president, gave a profile to Vogue recently. Yeah. And it was an interview plus a fashion spread, and that's kind of what we're reacting to. Rachel, you go first, because I feel like you had a intense reaction.
Rachel hated it, I think.
Right, and especially with industry stuff, I'm a little like almost toe the line a little bit. But this, I have to preface it, I did not read the article, and I only looked at one image. I just saw what had been sent to us.
Your first reaction.
And I gave my first, I called it my knee-jerk, my emotional reaction.
You're right.
But I felt a little bad afterwards when I researched it, but this was my emotional reaction.
Right, no, yeah.
Oh, no. Oh, no, this is not good. Yeah. And then we went back and forth because Christina said, you know, this is great, this is neat. And I thought, well, let's unpack why I felt that way. I did end up looking at more of the images and reading some of it. And I still actually did feel, oh no, because I think Vogue has its roots in selling not only a product, but an aspirational lifestyle, right? That's rooted in the exclusion of different classes and cultural differences. That has changed a lot. It's come a long way, but the history doesn't disappear. And so a photo shoot featuring luxury clothing in the backdrop of a city destroyed by war and surrounded by active men on duty, and then representing a person, yes, she is the first lady, but she happens to fit the aesthetic profile of what Vogue narrowly upheld for too long. And so all of those things combined made me really uneasy.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think that was it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I didn't have a reaction of, this is terrible, but I did have a reaction of, wait a minute. Huh? and is this a good idea or a bad idea? Like that was kind of my reaction. It was like immediate kind of engagement with the idea of it.
Yeah.
And I thought, I did have a fleeting thought of, because the medium itself is distracting, wouldn't it have been better in a New York Times or Wall Street Journal?
That's what I was going to ask you. Actually, Christina, too, do you think it might have worked better in a different outlet?
No way. Different audience.
Yeah, I've gone completely 180 on it because now that I've engaged with it more and have researched her more, like, so first of all, like, she didn't come out of, I think it would have been different if she'd come out of nowhere and done this Vogue profile, but she's been doing the work. She's been giving speeches, she's flown to Washington, she's been in every news paper, plus every television news outlet she's given interviews. The second and third reactions I had was, you know, the Zelenskys are so brilliant at making sure that we're paying attention mm-hmm. and we don't forget about them. And that this, would we be even having this conversation?
No. Right.
If well, not and they, for the decision.
And this yeah. came at a moment, quite frankly, this war has been going on since February.
Right.
And people were super excited about it at first. The world kind of rose and did sanctions against Russia and et cetera and so forth. And then it started to fall to the back. If you notice, if you look at news, it has not been top of mind in the news for a while now. I mean, this is one savvy administration over there in Ukraine. The guy who's head of digital for him, it's extraordinary. I wish we had him here in the United right. States, as a matter
right,
of fact.
Right, right.
But, you know, Olena Zelenska has not been out trying to build a career for herself outside of this. She was very quiet right. at first and very quiet prior to the war. So this is an effort. This would not be the same in the New York Times because the New York Times has been covering this war. People, New York Times readers know about it.
Right.
But I don't know about Vogue readers.
Well, they do. But now we're talking about it.
Right.
We're talking about yeah. it to maybe in That's a new way point. Into a new audience. I mean, I think my feeling is like, I was like, intellectually, this should be in a different, maybe fashion magazine mm-hmm. that has been more culturally accepting and maybe, but we wouldn't be talking about it. Like I'd right. be or something like that. We wouldn't be talking about it.
Right.
One more thing that I want to say that I thought was really significant is that in the photo editorials, which were shot by Annie Leibovitz, I mean, they did not go low on this, but if you look at the captions, they don't identify, they don't say, oh, this is Prada.
Yeah, I was struck
and then,
by this too.
Yeah, yeah. And they just say, here she is yeah. in this. And then one.
Me too. Me
yeah,
too.
Yeah, well, that was the right.
And I felt relief. I felt relief that they didn't dress her in some designers. And like that would have been.
Yeah.
And that was, I agree with you completely, Christina.
Yeah, it was. They did mention in one place that she was wearing all Ukrainian designers and they named them all, which is great.
Totally appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, quickly, we had a few people that were excited about Brad Pitt's clothes this week, or at least one particular outfit.
Yes.
Just have another look.
I've got to pull this up right now on the internet.
I just have to say Brad with the calves.
Yeah, I got to take another look at this.
It's a great skirt. He wore a skirt.
He did. Look great.
It got a lot of attention. The Wall Street Journal right. wrote about it. I thought Jacob Gallagher, who is a former colleague of mine or current colleague, and I adore his writing, and he always finds these quirky subjects, but he wrote this piece tying the success of Brad Pitt's skirt worn at a premiere for the movie he's promoting to sort of the publicity that it got and how successful it was because everybody was talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I liked it because it wasn't just a kilt.
Yeah.
It's a good skirt.
I liked it too.
My optimistic take on this and this trend in general
yeah.
of men sort of experimenting with fashion and even going into gender fluid or borrowing from female fashion is thank yeah. goodness. Like, culture is finally evolving, and it's so
yes.
cute that men are trying something new and they are having fun experimenting like teenagers or women in their early 20s. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting, and it's like I'm here for it. My yeah. end stage capital lens is men are having to commoditize their looks through style now, as women always have. I've been like, God,
you
well, because a lot it. Of the commentary about what Brad was wearing is he's doing it for PR. It's not just enough to show up in a suit anymore for men, that they need that wow factor. And I mean, I think yeah. Harry Styles uh-huh. has done it beautifully.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like it almost took me two looks to realize it was a skirt. I don't feel like this is a flashy way. He could have worn a mini skirt with sequins and then you would be like, okay, well, he's clear, you know. But this could be like, you know, giant shorts.
The boots help.
You almost yeah. wouldn't even notice it's a skirt. The boots, mm-hmm. the boots definitely help. I actually really like the outfit. It feels actually natural on him.
Yeah.
It's like, it feels like his style, something that he actually might, you know, pick out of his closet to wear. I actually don't like the boots.
Yeah,
I think
the proportions.
Exactly what
that's what I mean with like men are playing with style in a way that
the proportions are wrong.
That's true.
I totally agree yeah. with you, except that I don't think it's recent. I feel like it's been, especially like rock star, like David Bowie, Kurt
yeah.
Cobain, Andre 3000, and then like recently.
Motley Crue.
Yeah, exactly. Like people have been wearing dresses. I mean, men have been wearing dresses. And the idea
do you guys remember when Marc Jacobs wore he started wearing skirts. He started taking bows at his shows.
Yep.
Like, yes, this is like yes, seven yes, years ago, yes. right? Then he wore them to the Met yes. Ball with the pilgrim totally. Shoes.
And pearls.
Do you remember that?
He wears pearl earrings.
Yeah. I think that, I feel like that moment, Mark was still, when he did that, he was still leading ideas.
Yes.
And I think it started to bleed out because after that, we just started seeing a little bit more, a little bit there. And I feel like if you're doing the timeline, it would be Mark in, you know, in the skirt at the Met Ball and Brad at that, you know, in that, I forget the name of the designer because I'd not heard of him. The Wall Street Journal couldn't even reach the designer for comedy. He's so obscure.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It's very like Brad that. Pitt. It's not right. even somebody who has
it's
a website.
Totally awesome.
Yeah. It's
totally
like a friend of his probably who just made it.
Okay, well, these are moments of levity and wonderful things happening in fashion. Now, to talk about something, I'm super excited to talk about this because we're talking about returns, and that sounds like, who cares about returns, right? It's an afterthought. Send them back. But it turns out it is a huge topic. Mm-hmm. There's too many returns. The problem is getting worse as more shoppers order online from sites that make returning cheap and easy. It's all across retail. It's not just in fashion. I mean, I return a lot of stuff to Amazon. I'm sure you guys do too if it comes wrong. A recent New York Times article took a long look at how retailer inventory has built up as inflation was pinching consumer pocketbooks. And returns are making it worse because obviously there's more stuff coming back into those warehouses. The National Retail Federation and Appriss Retail, which is a software and analytics firm, it reported that in 2021, shoppers returned an average of 16.6% of their purchases, up from 10.6% in 2020, and more than double the rate in 2019. I know for a fact it's much higher than that in fashion. I hear that from retailers all the time. The data in the fashion industry is jarring. McKinsey, in a survey that was run just before COVID hit, found that 25% of apparel bought online was returned. And let's remember, that's an average. So some brands are getting way more than 25%.
Right.
And this kills me. An estimated 10% of all returns end up where? In a landfill. McKinsey also found that brands see it as a necessary evil, these returns, and they don't prioritize fixing returns. Instead, they're focused on shipping and logistics costs. I've talked about that with Rachel in the past, and we'll get back to that. Because it's kind of fascinating when you start to picture a warehouse with things going out and not being designed for things to come back in. This is a huge problem, not just for fashion brands, but for any progress to be made on sustainability. Returns mean more waste, they mean more emissions from shipping, and they contribute to the fast fashion mindset of this devalued apparel. The vast majority of what's being returned includes polyester. So if that ends up in landfills or the ocean, you're looking at more plastic waste, just as we're waking up to how bad that is for the planet and for our health. It's such a messy topic. Let's start digging in. First, I have to tell you that sitting by my desk is a box of clothes that I ordered for my daughter from Everlane, and I got a whole bunch of it in two different sizes so she could get the size that fit best, and I'm going to return, only it's been sitting there for a month.
Yeah,
so, and I feel guilty because I actually know that retailers need to get the returns quickly so that if they're going to sell them, they're not like old merchandise, and so I'm doing a disservice to Everlane by even having that there and being so lazy, but the truth is I love being able to do returns. I actually despise having to pack that stuff up and take it off someplace and get rid of it.
Right.
What about you guys?
Well, I think it's like the way we shop now, you know? There's a lot of internet native brands. So I don't think it's like, I always go back to like, it's not the consumer's fault. It's a system issue. I try not to. Almost because, though, it's out of laziness because it'll sit there and then I'll miss my return window or
totally.
I just end up keeping something that doesn't fit because I don't want to return it. It's not really because...
I'm exactly the same way.
Are you? Yeah, I think that the majority of returns are because of fast fashion. Like, we've turned into a culture that sort of wants to order as much as possible. And maybe, I think there's a lot of wishful thinking. Maybe I'll keep this because this was so cheap. And then people get disappointed because it doesn't fit or the quality's low or it doesn't look like how it did online. And then they return it. And the problem is a lot of people think it goes back onto the shelf and usually it doesn't.
I knew that there was a massive returns issue so the only time we will actually return something is we've moved into a fixer-upper of a house. So we're doing small projects around the house and and we'll order something for the house from Wayfair or something like that. And it'll come back, come in a size that we didn't expect or a style that doesn't actually quite work. And even if it's something like an outdoor chair, so something pretty big, we'll try to start initiate the returns process and they'll say, just keep it and we'll send you another one. And so then, and I'm like, whoa, okay, clearly there's something afoot here because that cannot make any kind of economic sense.
Really? That they would rather just write it off rather than get it back.
Exactly.
So it's more expensive for them to take it back.
Yeah. Right.
There's like 17 levels of this. Rachel, I remember, I don't know if you remember this, but sometime a year or two ago, I interviewed you about returns. I don't even remember why, but I so remember the conversation because it had never occurred to me until I spoke with you how well warehouses are. You know, we're so efficient at building these warehouses for shipping stuff out so that we can get it within a day or two of ordering it. But you explained to me what chaotic bumble mess it is on the way back into the warehouse. Bumble mess. Is that a word?
It's a word now.
It is now.
But the reason you interviewed me is because I ran a business for about a year. It was a startup. It was a pilot startup where I was basically trying to solve for this returns problem specifically for brands that don't want their inventory liquidated and are trying to become more conscious. And I was intaking their excess inventory and returns, but specifically their returns, and sorting it and then selling it in mystery boxes. It was the hardest year of my life in a lot of ways, but it gave me direct hands-on experience. Apparel is the highest returned product category in the world, really. Up to a third of apparel is returned, and a lot of it does not end up back on shelves, as we said. So brands are losing up to, 30 cents on the dollar.
Mm-hmm. Insane.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And they're worried about their margins.
Yeah.
But Rachel, what happens? Like, walk me through this. So I know, I can picture, the Amazon worker and the robot picking things up and packing it up and shipping it to me. But what happens when I return something? What's the process?
Well, it goes back to their distribution center or warehouse, which isn't necessarily owned by them and is really set up to send things back out, but not to take things back in and resell them. And you can understand why. I mean, if you walk through that process a little bit. So when it comes back to the distribution center or warehouse, there would need to be someone to inspect it, to smell it, to recategorize it, and to re-merchandise it somehow. And a lot of times what happens is not that, it just goes into a box with a bunch of other things and then it's mixed all together. And then eventually the warehouse will call the brand and call their CFO and say, you have 13 pallets of returns. What do you want us to do with them? And either it's liquidated or it's exported to another country or it's incinerated. And if you have product that you don't want on the market, a lot of times it'll be incinerated. So I was working with brands to take this in and to sort it and to re-merchandise it in mystery boxes so it wouldn't compete with their full price product.
In mystery boxes? So they would say, $35 and you get a surprise if you buy it?
$99 and you'll get $250 worth of product. And if, we were selling Everlane and Boyish and Lowe & Son. Part of the problem.
It's a cool idea.
It was a great idea. It's hard to scale. It was really an amazing experience, but it was really eye-opening in terms of what brands would tell us they were sending us versus what we got and the condition in which it would actually be in. So we might think we were going to get XYZ sweater, but we'd actually get a different style and it would have a little hole in it or something like that.
Oh.
Or it may not, this kind of category of inventory, there isn't inventory management systems for the trade of it. Or tracking of it. It's really labor intensive and it's very hard to scale this kind of business, especially when the brand is really careful about where they want it to go.
I'm trying to picture this because why don't they just, it comes back into the warehouse. I've got, that box of Everlane goods.
Why don't they
I'm
just figure
return.
It out?
Why don't they have somebody
it's
there?
It's $800 billion worth of returns every year, right? It's like something that scale, right?
Who's paying for that?
Yeah. I mean, so you pay somebody.
But the warehouse?
Whatever.
Or the brand?
Work at the warehouse and sort these things and put them back
Christina
on the shelves.
Christina would like to talk to Jeff Bezos and say,
yes,
what's
I
wrong
would.
With you? Yeah. I've got some ideas.
They're starting to partner with companies that do this because it's your warehouses that you're working from. You don't necessarily own that warehouse or pay that labor there, so you can't just get them to work in a different way, especially if it's they're going to be earning a lot less per unit for more work. You know what I mean? It's more expensive.
You mean the pickers? I'm going to call them the
gleaners. Yeah, the sorter, the refurbisher, okay. The cleaner, the remerchandiser. So there's now new, I mean, that's sort of onto another topic, but resale service providers are now becoming basically, they're calling themselves re-commerce companies, but they're dealing a lot with returns. And they're partnering with distribution centers and warehouses, even going in-house to establish, like, Renewal Workshop was one of the first re-commerce companies ever. And they got bought by a logistics company this year called Bleckman. And
Bleckman?
Bleckman.
Like B-L-A-C-K?
B-L-E-C-K-M-A-N-N, I believe.
Okay.
And they purchased Renewal Workshop, and now in their fulfillment centers, they're doing, you know, inspection, sorting, refurbishment, cleaning, re-merchandising on white label websites for brands. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the future.
Yeah. But I think the fundamental question, Christina, that you're raising is really important. It's like such a huge part of your business. So much. I mean, again, $800 billion, I think it's valued at in terms of product. Right?
Yeah, it's up to $600 billion lost.
And
yeah.
So it's why wouldn't companies invest in the infrastructure, or why wouldn't they address this problem? And I think my impression, and Rachel, tell me what you think. My impression is just that there's a little bit of a resignation among companies where it's just a necessary evil. It's just the cost of doing business almost.
Yeah.
To your point about the way that you shop for your daughter, I think companies expect that consumers expect now, especially because of the Amazonification of our own expectations of what we can receive and return online.
Right.
We believe we're going to bend the world to cater to our sense of convenience and comfort. Yeah. I want it tomorrow. I want free shipping, and I want to be able to return it anytime I want to. And if there's any friction along any part of that process, that's an extremely negative experience for me, and I probably won't come back. You've lost my trust. And the cheapest customer for a brand is one that is returning, not acquiring new ones. So I think they think of it as a cost of doing business and of retaining their customers. And also, I do think that there's a bias in general about focusing on kind of top line revenue generating initiatives versus investing in cost management strategies. And that's what this would be. And so I think those are some of the reasons. And Rachel, let me know if you disagree, agree. Some of the reasons why I feel like there's been inertia about addressing this issue.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But then you can take it a little further. It was a rounding error until it wasn't. Like, it was a cost of business until it wasn't, and it is no longer. Like, that's why Nike
30% is not a rounding error.
Right, and I think it's kind of like you see companies like Eddie Bauer, like Dick's, partnering with re-commerce providers now to intake. A lot of what you see as re-commerce on large company websites or small company websites is actually their returns. There's this blurred line between what's actually used clothing and returns, because it's basically the same category of product, which is a very hard to manage. Oftentimes single unit SKU that needs to be inspected and re-tagged, needs to be handled by a human. And I think kind of in the way that the front end of the supply chain has kind of become a mess, and we're trying to redo it now, and it's tough, and there's a lot of money being lost on the problems there. Same with the reverse supply chain. It's like, it is a problem, but it's a systemic problem that's going to take a while to fix.
You know who would be a monster at solving this problem?
Who?
Rent the Runway. Because
They're
exactly the opposite of most consumer brands. 98% of their products are, they've had to master this reverse
idea. And they clean everything. They have deals with dry cleaners. They're like,
no, but not only do they have, it's more than deals with dry cleaners. They actually operate their own in-house dry cleaning system. I think it's the largest dry cleaning system. Maybe around the world, for sure in the U.S.
Wow.
And they built all their tech and logistics and operations around receiving products back from customers. Jen Hyman said on a recent interview that it goes into 26 separate paths, specific types of cleaning, tailoring, putting it back onto the shelves to be reused again. And I imagine, you know, not that she isn't busy with their strategic priorities, but if they wanted to outsource that capability and know-how for other companies, that could be pretty powerful.
Well, listen, they're getting into resale. They've announced that formally. Yeah. So resale is also returns. So maybe they're getting into that.
I wonder if that's interesting, because they've been reselling their own stuff for years. Yep. They would sort of offer it to their clients because they get like 6-7 wears out of something and then they want to sell it. They don't want it to get worn looking. So it's interesting that they're now doing resale, expanding that. They built the logistics for it, right? So why not resell more?
Yeah.
Okay, we got to get Jen on here. She's a great interviewer.
That would be great.
I want to say, Sheila, you mentioned a minute ago friction. There is some friction. I don't know if this is going to spread or not. I was curious about when I read this, but Boohoo, which is a fast fashion company, as we know, has announced that they're going to start charging, I think, £1.99 British pounds for returns, which you used to have to pay for returns, or there'd be incredibly like 10-day windows to return and things like that. That was a long time ago. And I thought this was very interesting. Mm-hmm. Are you going to pay £1.99 for a shirt you paid £12 for? I mean, is this a really stupid idea for them? Or are we going to see more of this?
I think it's a good slap on the wrist and sets precedent. Mm. That's how I look at it.
Ah, interesting.
And also in the UK, shipping's less. So it's a pretty big slap on the wrist when you can ship in the UK, I think, for like $4, £4.
Meaning you think this is a good move, Rachel?
Yeah, I do. And I'm glad Zara kind of started it, or was the first fast fashion company that announced, I think, a similar sort of rate. And then Boohoo followed. Everybody thought, this is either a terrible business for Zara, and they'll just remove it and not announce that because they'll alienate their customers. But you've seen others follow along, and that shows you how big of a problem it is.
I don't know what shipping rates are like, but my first reaction was like, that seems like a Band-Aid on a geyser, mm-hmm. because in the U.S., most companies who are starting to do this are charging between $5 to $15 to just simply cover the cost of shipping, let alone all the costs and infrastructure that they've yet to build, which is how do you sort it back and get it back to the right place so it can be resold again. So I think, it's a movement in the right direction. And on top of that, I think all of these companies are going to need to invest in that long-term infrastructure of how do you sort inventory that comes back to get it to the right place.
There's another added value for companies like Zara that have a lot of stores, though. Because I know Nordstrom does this, too. They love to encourage people to return stuff in-store because they get the person in the store. And rarely do people walk out without sniffing around and seeing if there's something else they like. So they actually can. Nordstrom has found that when they started putting returns desks really near a front door to make it super convenient for people to come in. I can't remember the number, but it was more than 50% of the people who returned stuff also bought something new while they were there.
I think there's also more likelihood if you have people returning to store that it's actually going to go back on the shelf. Not always. I mean, I've even heard stories of the things you try on in a dressing room, especially in fast fashion retailers. It's not enough for them to restock them.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty bad. But I think there is more likelihood if you do encourage your customers to return in store, especially for a little higher value things, that they're going to return. Because also with returns, think about this. It could be end of season. It might not, by the time it gets back, sorted, inspected, refurbished, cleaned, and restocked, it might be out of season, So there's a timing thing, especially as we have more and more seasons. So returning in store is, I think, a good direction.
Better for everybody.
It's funny. At Thrilling, we've looked at, to your point, Rachel, there's now all these great startups in the space who are trying to tackle this problem from all sorts of different angles. There's one called Happy Returns. We are actually partnering with now, and they offer 5,000 locations across the U.S. If you're a small company like us or a bigger company, you can now offer your customers to return to any of their locations.
Like Staples, right? Don't they partner with a bunch of Staples?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I think I've used this place.
It's really convenient.
It's super convenient, especially if you're a brand that doesn't have a huge retail footprint. So you can offer your customers the ability to go send it back in store. So I thought that was a really interesting model.
I love that as a consumer, partly because just returning stuff pisses me off and I'm really bad about getting around to it. But then that makes me mad at myself too, right? Like that Everlane box that's sitting by my desk is driving me crazy.
There's one other startup that I'm curious how you guys react to this. It's called Seal.
S-E-A-L?
S-E-S? S is in Sam. E-E-L. Oh, okay. And they offer brands what they're calling returns insurance. So you're on a company's website that you're shopping at, you're checking out of your cart, and you're going to see a line item that says $5 returns insurance, so that it allows you as a customer to be able to return freely. And this company Seal then takes on the risk of the return, and the brand takes on no risk or liability. So if you return an item, Seal will refund you the money. They'll take the product back. I'm not really sure what they're going to do with the products. So they're offering this new idea of returns insurance, charging it to the customer and taking the financial risk and the operational liability away from the brand.
Right.
What do you guys think of that idea?
That's Wall Street taking over again. It just adds another layer of finance, and it doesn't do anything about solving the returns problem.
Right, exactly.
Shifting the money around.
Both of the last examples we gave solves a consumer problem and a brand problem, but where do the returns go? How do they get back on the shelf? That's what no one has figured out. I spoke with a company like Sealed. I can't remember if it was them. And they approached me and they were asking me when I was running that business if I could sell their returns.
Oh, interesting.
How come you didn't do that business, Rachel?
Oh, that's a whole other podcast episode. The website is still up. I might still do
What's it called?
It's called Kept Skew. And I might still do it. It's on pause. But I have another direction I would want to take it in, which is secret. But I think I learned a lot.
Secrets.
The next iteration of that business would be a little different.
Okay, well, we obviously have to talk to that issue in the future when you're ready to talk about it. Something else that we're talking about again already, and we're only on our seventh podcast. Last week, do you guys remember we talked with Amanda Shendrick of Quartz? She'd done this great investigation that actually came out of her looking for a coat to take on vacation at H&M, and she found that they were... they had some very deceptive labels about how green that coat was and a lot of other things. Well, that story is not over. It's gone places. Her story is, and there's more. Sourcing Journal just reported this week or last week that there's a class action lawsuit was filed in the Southern District of New York, where they do a lot of good consumer protection lawsuits. This month, it's accused H&M of deceiving consumers about the veracity of H&M's sustainability claims through the use of, quote, false and misleading, end quote, environmental scorecards and advertising. The lawsuit cited a June investigation by news outlet Quartz, which said it found errors in more than half of the scorecards H&M used to assert that an item of clothing was better for the planet. So H&M is in some real hot water now. It's gotten legal. Is that scary? Is that
for
H&M? I mean, scary for them, not for us, right? Like, it's literally, I can't believe it. I have had years of obvious greenwashing. I mean, I'm inundated on a daily basis with press releases from brands saying that this is sustainable, that's sustainable. I used to actually try to parse through them. Now I'm like, you claim you're sustainable, delete, right? Because they just, I feel like they're just never
that's
living
so
up.
Bad.
I love how Christina screens her sustainable PR press releases.
I mean, just saying it's green or sustainable or something, if there's not something that looks like science in that press release proving it, it's just...
Honestly, if I were a company that claims sustainability, I would be very worried about these cases. Mm-hmm. I would be looking through, you know, what do we have online and how are we talking about it? Because remember, Amanda, she's this incredible journalist, but she used her skills as just a shopper.
Right.
That's right. It wasn't kind of investigative reporting that uncovered it. It was just,
she just wanted clothes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I would be very concerned about other citizens' arrests coming my way. And
how do you two feel about this? I was actually surprised that I didn't think it could go there, even though I know there's class action lawsuits all the time.
Maybe one of my reasons for not thinking that it would go there is because the damage... I mean, even Chelsea Commodore, this woman who you can't find much about her.
A mystery woman. I love it.
Mystery woman.
Can you file a lawsuit under a pseudonym, by the way? Because I couldn't.
I was wondering that too, whether it was I think it is.
I think it's a pseudonym.
Maybe it's Christina.
I found one woman on LinkedIn named Chelsea Commodore, and I don't think just based on the professional
It might be. I mean, I think it's maybe, it might be smart to protect yourself. But, she's not, because what are the damages? And so I think that's why... it's not something that came to mind as a class action lawsuit.
Because you're not obviously...
Right, exactly.
Well, what we didn't bring up, actually, I realized in our interview with Amanda that was pointed out in one of these articles about the lawsuit is that they were more expensive
I noticed that too.
Although being less sustainable. So that's
maybe that's where you go for the damages.
Yep.
My other question that I would have for Amanda if we had her back on was do we know how long they've been up? For what period of time and how much, what was the premium that they were charging for these products? And then, you know, that's where you kind of get to your answer.
I got to think that there's a lot of different ways that you could prove damages. You could prove damages, I guess you have to for an individual because it's a class action lawsuit.
Right.
But what if a hot dog company was selling vegan hot dogs and then it turned out that they're full of pork guts?
Yeah.
You wouldn't sue based on the price differential.
No,
you would be.
That's
you would
true.
Sue based on, I had a belief in this product that is in line with my lifestyle, right? So I feel like it's the same kind of thing.
And we're probably applying a higher bar because I think it's purely for false advertising. I think just on that basis alone, you have a legal claim.
Right. So watch out, greenwashers.
I also liked how she went into recycling and sort of mentioned that, you know, they're running these recycling programs that aren't actually recycling. And that goes into basically a lack of definition and standards that we need desperately,
100%,
right?
Yes.
In this industry, because in the industry that they're working with in recycling, they do call themselves recycling and it's reuse, which isn't necessarily wrong, but it is misleading to a lot of customers.
Exactly.
There's no way of claiming sustainability right now without policy, definition, standards, you know, baseline data. And then the question is, I mean, I think what this lawsuit does is the response to it will show us which direction sort of we're going in terms of holding companies accountable. But what they can't do is call themselves sustainable right away by taking a few months to figure out how to be sustainable, because fundamentally fast fashion models aren't necessarily sustainable and we haven't grappled with that. So there's a lot on the policy and regulation, definition and standards front that really needs to happen to call yourself sustainable, I think.
Yeah. As usual, I always like to look at, you know, where, you know, is there a parallel example in a different industry where it worked, kind of this definition of language issue? And I feel like, you know, you look at the history of the word organic and how did that regulation come to pass?
Yeah.
And it was interesting because there was obviously decades of misuse and consumer mistrust with that word because it was applied irregularly for a long time. But there was a case in 1989 where a chemical that was used as an apple ripening agent was found to cause cancer in kids. Yes, it was like this huge scandal, right? And it was like exactly the level of scandal that you needed to kind of jumpstart federal action. And that led to the next year, the Organic Foods Production Act, which was the law that kind of regulated, okay, how are we going to define this term and what does it exactly mean? The thing that I'm curious about is whether these cases will rise to that level. Because with the Apple case, you know, it was on the cover of every magazine.
Yeah.
It led the top of every newscast. It's apples and kids and cancer.
Yeah.
Like, you
know,
there's
tough.
Nothing more visceral.
I think fashion and beauty have a harder time. They have a harder case to make because you're not like ingesting it, even though you kind of are through your skin. Like even in our last episode, we talked about how there's trace amounts of asbestos in kids' makeup and it can't even like move through Congress to stop that, you know, that practice.
I think most people don't think about that. That they are absorbing their clothing through their skin.
Yeah.
I mean, they like wrinkle-free men's shirts, you know? They put formaldehyde and other chemicals in the fabric so that you don't have to iron it. But those they've proven this. They find the formaldehyde being absorbed through the skin.
I did not know that, and that is quite disturbing. Okay.
The UK recently has been attempting to do some regulations about this. They announced that they're investigating three companies, ASOS, Boohoo, and Asda. I wasn't just familiar. Asda, ASDA, I think it's a grocery store, as you guys know?
Yep.
Anyway, they're being investigated. There's a preliminary look in January. Gave the UK reason to dig in deeper. It sounds like the issue is creating some eco-friendly lines of clothing. At least they sound eco-friendly, but they're not detailing how they are. ASOS has something called the Responsible Edit, and Boohoo has Ready for the Future. Asda has George for Good. And they say that they're using recycled materials in the clothing, but it's not always clear how much they're using. We've seen this, we've talked about this in the past, right? Or even what those recycled materials are. And it may be that some items may not have any recycled materials at all, even though they claim it. So the UK is investigating this. It sounds like they're are some moves. It's sort of government by nation by nation, right? As to which nations are going to come down.
And it's all happening at
hard
once
on these claims.
And it's all happening at once, which is interesting. I think that this reminded me sort of I think it is sort of parallel to the FTC and our green guides, which also have need updating right now. So what they're claiming, the UK law in the UK lawsuit, is that these brands are in violation of the Green Claims Code, and that they have labeling systems that lack clarity or marketing claims that lack clarity and are even being misused. For instance, saying that claiming a garment is made out of recycled fibers and not saying how many, or saying that a garment is using BCI cotton, which is a certain kind of standard of cotton, which is respected, but though the cotton only being used in trims or a small portion of the garment. So even if they win, though, I still go back to the same question I was asking earlier, is like, what is their definition of a recycled garment? What is that threshold? Do they have definitions and standards around this? Because if not, then those policymakers need to work with brands to do that so we can all get on the same page about what it means to be sustainable. Otherwise, we're going to call ourselves like conscious and sustainable, like everybody's operating in the dark, really. And it, of course, will be abused.
You know, it feels like we did that in the food industry years ago. We totally have an example of how to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a roadmap.
Exactly.
We just need to do it.
Yeah, we have a roadmap.
Exactly.
Do you guys feel optimistic about this? Do you feel like we're entering a new era?
Mm-hmm. I do.
I think so.
The era of accountability.
It's the consumer pressure has happened, and now we're getting policy pressure. And I think that's, like, Shilla, you always talk about how we've seen this happen in other industries before, and this is kind of what needs to happen, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I think there's pressure from every angle, from businesses and startups and the startup community, and from consumers, from policymakers now, start increasingly. And so I think it's inevitable. There's this case that I had never heard of, but have you guys heard of this, like, the largest organic fraud case?
No.
Have you heard about this?
No.
About this guy?
Is this happening now?
No, it was a couple of years ago. So essentially, there was this farmer who apparently had sold over a period of 7 years, $120 million worth of products, advertised as organic, but actually weren't. And, you know, there was a main farmer that was kind of leading the charge on it, and there were a few other farmers involved as well. But the main person got a 10-year prison sentence in 2019 for it.
Whoa, prison. That's teeth.
Yeah, so that's teeth right there. I mean, usually you get fines or you get barred from the industry. I think this is the first time somebody's gotten a prison sentence for it. But I'm sure, Rachel, you would agree, you can't have these policies without an effective remediation mechanism.
There has to be consequences. Yeah. And I think that there's also some low-hanging fruit here. It doesn't need to be as complicated as we'd think. I read a paper by a lawyer named Bettina Baumgarten, and she talks about how we could update labeling laws fairly easily. And they haven't, our garment labels, clothing labeling, they haven't been updated since 1958. And she argues that the reason we created clothing labels was very much for the same reasons that we need to update our clothing labels now. And it was for increased transparency with industrialization. People wanted to know that their wool wasn't being combined with cheaper fibers. And they wanted to know how to care for their garments if they were being combined with cheaper fibers, because they no longer knew how to care for these items. They would care for them in the same way, and then they would be destroyed. I guess at that time, there was a strong sort of preference for American-made, and people wanted to know that their items were being made in America. And now we have these labels that haven't been updated since 1958, and we need to know the same things but more now with globalization, meaning we should know which factory the items were made in, not just the final country of origin where they were put together. And then we also sort of need to know how much recycled content.
Yeah, exactly. And what's recycled?
The garment. You know? Yeah, is it pre or post-consumer? Is it made from plastic bottles or what? And then also with the rise of e-commerce, e-commerce on websites, we're not required to put labels, basically. Like when you go to the item, you don't have to show the, you don't have to show how to care for the item, what it's made of, where it was made. So you don't understand that until you actually get it in the mail.
That's an interesting
so
point.
That could be contributing to returns as well. Like, oh, I didn't want to have to dry clean this. I'm sending it back. You know, so
we feel like there's some movement. There's an increased interest in accountability in apparel and what's in apparel, as there was many, you know, decades ago in the food industry. The fashion industry is trailing far behind, but maybe we're getting someplace. We need pressure on legal authorities around the world to put some teeth in, in the regulations. Okay, let's move on to our hot buttons. I always like to hear what's on you guys' mind. Have your buttons been pressed this week? Always.
Always. Always. Okay, well, I just wanted to shout out my friend, Alexander Debat. He has a line of bags called Any Bag that he makes out of his family's garment factory in the garment district. He's a leather goods maker, like a really high quality leather goods maker. And when they lost a lot of their business during COVID, what he started to do was retool some of his looming machines for plastic bags recovered from New York City streets. And he got featured in the New York Times either this week or last for having now recycled 588,000 bags. It's now 10% of his revenue.
That's amazing.
You know, I had a plastic bag hot button this week too. So you guys know I'm up at our family's vacation place, and I was having some work done in the house. And I've got this painter and his son who are from Mexico, who've been working with us for years. And the son, who's like 21 years old, was looking for a garbage bag to throw some stuff away. And and I said, oh, you know, they're over here. And I mentioned, because they looked a little funny, that I don't buy plastic bags, I buy the compostable bags. But I said, but it'll work just fine. And he said, oh, good, I'm so glad to see that. He goes, you know, in Mexico, you can't get plastic bags anymore. They were outlawed a few years ago. I was like, oh, what?
Yeah, we're behind,
I mean, I haven't confirmed that, have you got? But I mean, I trust him. He's just been in Mexico.
Yeah, I was just at a seminar. And there were some folks from Europe there who just could not believe that you could get plastic bags in the States. And just
maybe we in the U.S. need to hear more about the fact that plastic bags everywhere is not actually the norm or necessary.
Right, right. My hot button will feel slightly irrelevant to what we usually talk about, but I'm going to bring it back full circle, I promise. So it's about this company, Dollar Tree. Are you guys familiar with this company?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's one around the corner
rural
from my
America.
House.
Absolutely. Oh, not even rural.
Although it looks like Dollar E because
some of the lights are on.
Light.
Yeah. Oh. So this company, I've been reading up on them. For folks who may not be aware, they're headquartered in Virginia. They're about 30 years old at this point. 16,000 stores across the country, 200,000 employees, $26 billion in revenue. So this is actually a massive. I didn't realize how big this company is. They're usually located near low-income communities. They do they do offer some essentials in some of their locations, like toilet paper and some basic groceries. But for the most part, they're offering kind of seasonal or holiday toys or trinkets or decorations. They're in the news this week because the Department of Labor found more than 300 safety violations for their employees and fined them $1.3 million. Obviously not good. But I think they're worth paying attention to for another reason. Their business model is really similar to fast fashion in that they're producing high quantity goods at very low costs and obviously reselling it to consumers at very low costs.
Oh, I thought they were just liquidation.
No.
They're producing their own. I thought it was like TJ Maxx where it was like liquidated mostly.
They have their own supply chain, and their model rests on the idea that the consumer disposes of the products that they buy and buys more and more every year. So really similar to fast fashion. And the thing that's really interesting is that right now, activist shareholders have been trying to hold them accountable for their impact on the environment and getting them to commit to net zero greenhouse gas emissions. And the management has been fighting these shareholders, they're in the middle of this fight right now. And it'll be really interesting to see how it lands because I think there will be some insights about ways in which we, in the broader sense, might engage with fast fashion companies. Anyway, very interesting. Yeah.
That is interesting. Good one. Well, that is all for the show. Please, listeners, support us by following us on Twitter. We're at Hot Buttons Pod. Or send a link to friends or colleagues and go to Apple or Spotify and give us a rating. We really appreciate your support. If you want to email us with story ideas, send a note to hotbuttons@postscriptaudio.com. Hot Buttons is hosted by me, Christina Binkley, Sheila Kim Parker, and Rachel Kibbe. The show is produced by Postscript Media. Our senior editor is Anne Bailey. Yes, Anne! Our senior engineers are Greg Villefranc and Sean Marquand. Cecily Meza-Martinez is our managing producer. Stephen Lacey, Scott Clavenna, and Rachel Kibbe are our executive producers. Postscript Media makes podcasts at the intersection of climate with culture, politics, business, and tech. Postscript Media is supported by Prelude Ventures. Prelude is a venture capital firm focused on climate solutions across energy, food, agriculture, transportation, logistics, and advanced materials. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch up with you next week. Don't buy those things. Just iron or go wrinkly. What's wrong with wrinkly?
Right. Right. Look at Brad Pitt in his skirt. That was very wrinkly, and he looks great.